My guest is poet Sharon Olds. Her second book of poems, The Dead and the Living, won the 1985 National Book Critics Circle Award. In her latest collection, The Gold Cell, many of the poems are about being a daughter, mother, and wife. David Levitt wrote, "Sharon Olds is enormously self-aware. Her poetry is remarkable for its candor, its eroticism, and its power to move." Poet Diane Wachowski said, "What makes me read and admire Olds' poems is an obsession which runs through every poem, destruction. There is not a single poem by Sharon Olds which does not intertwine destruction and creation." Sharon Olds has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Nation, and The New Republic. She's taught at Brandeis, Columbia, and New York University, where she's now the director of creative writing. I spoke with her from the NPR Bureau in New York. I wanted her to read her poem Summer Solstice, which is about someone who almost committed suicide by jumping off a building. But first I wanted to know if the poem was about someone she knew or someone she read about in the newspaper.
It's not always a safe assumption to make in many poets' work that it really happened at all.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But in this case, it did. It was something that happened across the street, right across the street from where I live. So it wasn't someone that I knew, but it wasn't something that I read in a paper. It was something that I watched as it unfolded, hiding.
You were hiding while you watched?
Well, I was hiding behind the corner of my shutter because I didn't know if he had a gun or what would happen. So I wanted to see it, and I wanted to see it provided he was going to live. I was sort of praying, and I wanted to see it, but I didn't want a wild shot to come in my direction. I live on a street in New York where wild shots have sometimes come in people's directions.
Right.
So this was, and I had just come back to New York from the ocean where I'd been visiting a friend, so it all seemed very vivid to me.
Would you read the poem?
I'd be happy to. Summer Solstice, New York City. By the end of the longest day of the year, he could not stand it. He went up the iron stairs through the roof of the building and over the soft, tarry surface to the edge, put one leg over the complex green tin cornice, and said if they came a step closer, that was it. Then the huge machinery of the earth began to work for his life. The cops came in their suits, blue-gray as the sky on a cloudy evening, and one put on a bulletproof vest, a black shell around his own life, life of his children's father, in case the man was armed. And one, slung with a rope like the sign of his bounden duty, came up out of a hole in the top of the neighboring building, like the gold hole they say is in the top of the head, and began to lurk toward the man who wanted to die. The tallest cop approached him directly, softly, slowly, talking to him, talking, talking, while the man's leg hung over the lip of the next world, and the crowd gathered in the street, silent, and the hairy net with its implacable grid was unfolded near the curb and spread out and stretched as the sheet is prepared to receive at a birth. Then they all came a little closer, where he squatted next to his death, his shirt glowing its milky glow like something growing in a dish at night in the dark in a lab, and then everything stopped as his body jerked, and he stepped down from the parapet and went toward them, and they closed on him. I thought they were going to beat him up, as a mother whose child has been lost will scream at the child when it's found. They took him by the arms and held him up and leaned him against the wall of the chimney, and the tall cop lit a cigarette in his own mouth and gave it to him. And then they all lit cigarettes, and the red glowing ends burned like the tiny campfires we lit at night back at the beginning of the world.
I think that poem really gets a sense of how everyone feels very threatened by a suicide. Not threatened by the possibility of a stray shot headed toward them, but the fact that someone would want to take their life is a kind of threat to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To everybody else's equilibrium and sense of well-being.
Yes, I was talking to a class at NYU a while ago about endings of poems, and we all discovered together while working in the class that sometimes I would feel a poem didn't work at the end, But it was because I wanted a happy ending on the poem. And we decided to call me a salvation addict. So now that I read this to you, I hear, yes, it's definitely a poem of a salvation addict whose addiction is, whose craving is being satisfied for once by the event there on 97th Street.
Did you rewrite that poem a lot?
I didn't have to a lot. I always have to go back and take out adjectives, because I always put too many in, wanting to describe very precisely, but then it starts sounding so literary that I go back and take them out. But I remember the end was hard to get right. Those last four lines, I did over and over. I have maybe three or four pages in my ShopRite notebook with things written and crossed out and then written and crossed out.
This poem that you just read is about something that you witnessed that obviously had a powerful effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of your poems are very personal, about your life, your upbringing, your parents, your children, your husband, your first lover, your best girlfriend who died when she was nine. They're very, very personal poems. And in a way, I think some of those poems are the kinds of thoughts you'd write in a diary that had a lock on it, and you'd keep that diary locked so no one else could see it.
Mm-hmm.
Did that ever bother you when you started writing poems, that you'd be writing a poem about your parents and they'd find it?
Well, what I look at in these poems, the way I look at any poems that I read or poems of young poets that I'm working with, they are poems as if to the parents of the speaker. I would never talk about them as poems about my parents, my husband, my children. I keep my private life very separate in my mind and in public from my life as a writer. So to me, there it's a speaker talking about parents. To me, that, and say I read someone else's poem and it's as if to their own parent. Does it matter to me if it was really to their own parent? No. What matters to me in their poem is if I feel that I'm present at a human experience that's being described in a way that feels real or useful or moving or visualizable to me. So that's a somewhat different take on the question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, with that said, would you read a poem for us called I Go Back to May, 1937?
Sure. I go back to May, 1937. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, with the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips black in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. They are dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you never heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Her hungry, pretty, blank face turning to me. Her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. His arrogant, handsome face turning to me. His pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. But I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it.
So is that poem about your parents, or do you prefer to think of it as a poem about somebody's parents, just a poem about parents, but not necessarily yours?
Yes, it's similar with my own work as with work of others that I look at. The important thing to me, for any of us, is, I mean, you know, no one reads poetry. Almost no one reads it.
Right.
Everyone, almost, who hasn't written a poem at some time in their life? Most people have written something. That need to speak is familiar to us all. But to read it, no. I don't know why, really. But if one were to be able to need to write poems that happen to seem as if they were by anybody or for anybody, or whose desire to share experience was such that the biographical side of it wasn't so interesting to readers as just the truth of it, or the apparent truth, or just if it felt like anybody, like a real person.
I'm trying to figure out if this poem and the other very personal poems like it are really very personal to you, but you'd rather just not talk about the personal experiences that they came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
Could you talk a little about that desire of yours, about where it comes from or what the meaning of that is? Why want to know as a reader?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And when I was reading your poems last night and thinking about what we were going to talk about in the interview, I was thinking, well, really, what makes Sharon Olds interesting to me? Do I really care what her parents were like, or do I really care that she writes good poetry? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I really care that she writes good poetry. But then I said, but I'm also interested in the parts of her life that inspired the poems mm-hmm. that she writes about, and how those experiences helped her become the poet she is today.
Mm-hmm. I've had a very interesting experience in teaching, in that by the end of a semester, and I've spoken, you know, in private to all the students in the workshop, and I taught two workshops one semester, and they at two different schools, and by the end of the semester, every woman writer in the workshops had asked me questions about privacy. Who to show the work to, who to stop showing it to, mm-hmm. what the mother felt about it, what the lover had said, whether they were having writing block problems because of that. And none of the men. It was like perfect record. Zero, 16 or something, had asked me those questions. And it wasn't that I wasn't close to them. We were writers working together on poems. We were very close to each other. But for the women, it was a very important issue. And I know that among men poets whom I know who have written about family, I say to them, well, what do you say when you're asked about your specific, you know, child or parent? And they say, well, I'm not asked that much. So I don't know if part of what you and I are participating in here mm-hmm. at this moment has to do with women having traditionally been, what can I say, like vessels of feeling, the hearts, you know, in the body politic, and that if they are speaking about actual family members, it's somehow more, I don't know if it's scary, you know, or interesting or what. I've gone through a whole history of thinking and feeling about all of this. You know, this is at the end of, I've just given my fourth book to my editor. So when I first started out, I didn't know what I thought about all of this. So mm-hmm. if you had asked me this question 10 years ago, I would have probably given a very different answer. But I've come to not worry about these questions or be interested in them in the same way. And also for writers that I'm working with, if they're writing about something merely because it's true or because they have a strong feeling about it, you know, as a poem, it's not necessarily going to work. It has to jump the fence somehow, just, or knock it down. And the poem has to be free to lead its own life.
Mm-hmm. So you don't like talking about your own life, but just the life of the poems?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Now, here's one thing I would wonder. One of the emotions that you expressed in the poem that you just read is the sense of, like, knowing that these two people who will become your parents are not fated to love each other for very long, and you'd really like to go back and make them stop that relationship, but it would mean that you would not be born. I think this is probably an emotion that a lot of people have had. And that probably a lot of people have tried to control. Do you know, there's a lot of thoughts that come to your mind and you think, I shouldn't be thinking this. This is really bad to think.
Yeah.
I think what a poet would do would be to confront the thought and write a poem about it, as opposed to trying to repress the thought.
Yes, that must be one of the uses of poetry in our time besides the singing of language itself without melody. It seems to me both of those impulses are probably equally strong in the poems that I read that I like the most. It's hard to know what the function of poetry is in our society. I mean, sometimes one feels it's so tiny. But I think you're right that desire to say what hasn't been said, to have, to make an object or a little being on the page, like the poem, you know, the way it sits there with its body on the page, to give that less often mentioned thought or feeling from inside the person. Yeah, I like your idea. That rings a bell for me.
Yeah. When did you start to write?
Well, I wrote as a kid, and I wrote as a teenager, and then I wrote fiction in college, terrible, trash in college. And somehow for me, working with the line, working with a small shaped form, helped me some with my problems of sentimentality and the adjective. I guess it's partly that my desire to find the shape of something soon, right? Rather than in a novel where I guess, I just don't know what they do, but I mean, they must have an enormous long-range sense of shape. But I don't. I'm less patient, and my eagerness to get the poem out of my mind, out of my body in a sense, on the page, to make more room, kind of more air inside of me, just ordinary air to breathe and lead a life kind of unburdened by the as yet unshaped realization of that kind of little thought that you mentioned that you have in your mind sometimes that you brush aside, but instead of brushing it aside, to realize it and get it out. And then there's a little free space, you know, a little park in there instead.
The poem that you just read, I go back to May 1937, about the parents. The last line in the poem is, "Do what you're going to do, and I will tell about it." Have you found in your life that telling about things, that making poems about things, gives you a certain power? Because finally, no matter what anyone has said or done to you, or done in your presence, you have the power to tell it the way you perceive it, and to give it its final interpretation, at least in your mind and in the life of that poem.
That's nice. I bet that's a strong unconscious involvement of mine in poetry. It's not very conscious. I mean, what I would perceive more is the pleasure of playing with language, the relief of speaking, the satisfaction of feeling the line turn at the end and come back to the left-hand margin, that kind of dance, that kind of physical dance of the poem. Sure, I bet a lot of it has to do with power. Consciously, no. A poet is not likely to feel powerful, I don't
right.
think. It's not it's not as bad a danger for us, but I'm sure that that's a satisfaction of it that I'm usually not conscious of, but that's there.
My guest is poet Sharon Olds. Her second book, The Dead and the Living, won a 1985 National Book Critics Circle Award. Her latest collection of poems is titled The Gold Cell. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Can we go back to your students for a second? When you talk to the women students who you teach and go over with them the question of privacy and personal life, what advice do you give them?
Well, I say that it's individual. There's no rule. At different times in our life, with different people in our life, it's the right thing to do to be more or less open. I talk about what I call the spectrum of loyalty and betrayal. On one end of it, being saying everything, naming names. You know, reading, hearing your friend talk to you about their intimate life, writing a poem about it with all the names, dates, and times, and publishing it. I mean, there we're over by betrayal, a kind of almost a very destructive impulse, I would say. So over at the other side, you would have someone who is so loyal that they don't even write the poem about the person.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that they write it and don't publish it, they don't even write it. And then you go even further over and they don't even think the thought. And then you go all the way over to that end, you have a self-destructiveness that's very extreme. Now, of course, most of the transactions about loyalty and betrayal and art occur close to the middle. But I try to lay it out for them, and I try to say that I can't tell them what they should do. I've made mistakes. You just try to do the right thing by the living people and, you know, the dead and the possible readers. I mean, by the human in its large self and in its small specific selves that you know.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Sure.
And this is from an earlier volume of poems called The Dead and the Living. And the poem I'll ask you to read is called New Mother.
Yes. New Mother. A week after our child was born, you cornered me in the spare room and we sank down on the bed. You kissed me and kissed me. My milk undid its burning slipknot through my nipples, soaking my shirt. All week I had smelled of milk, fresh milk, sour. I began to throb. My sex had been torn easily as cloth by the crown of her head. I'd been cut with a knife and sewn, the stitches pulling at my skin. And the first time you're broken, you don't know you'll be healed again, better than before. I lay in fear and blood and milk while you kissed and kissed me, your lips hot and swollen as a teenage boy's, your sex dry and big, all of you so tender. You hung over me, over the nest of the stitches, over the splitting and tearing, with the patience of someone who finds a wounded animal in the woods and stays with it, not leaving its side until it is whole, until it can run again.
That's a beautiful poem. Do you remember writing the poem?
No. This is a long time ago now.
So is it like a found poem to you? do you not remember it at all?
It was. Yeah.
And what did you think about when you read it?
You have great hearing. I thought I liked it. I liked the ending. When it came to the wounded animal, I was sort of rewriting there. I thought, oh, that's a little corny. And then when it came to the kissed and kissed, I've been writing so much love poetry. I'd say this poem is maybe 10 years old. I've been writing lots of love poems in the last, 5 years, 2 years, year. And I was just looking to see how guarded this was, how much it was going to keep itself to, how shy it was. And I thought it was rather shy.
Oh, it kind of needed to be shy in that sense, though, because
the
mother's so vulnerable in it. I mean, yes. It can't be a sexual poem in that respect. I mean,
right. Yeah, that's right.
So how come you're writing a lot of love poems now?
I don't know. What a good question. Part of it, I think... sometimes when people say, how difficult to be a woman poet... I think of all the poems, however, that haven't been written because most of the poets weren't women. So that is poems that are written from, or as if from, personal experience. So that to be able to, I mean, it's exciting to an artist to want and need to be writing about something that hasn't already been done a lot. So being a woman is a wonderful thing in that way, and especially with love poetry and erotic poetry, so little of it has been written by women or by men. So I guess once I started noticing that I was liking writing that, then the fact that it hadn't been done a huge amount was also, I guess, kind of exciting or reassuring to me, as if I wasn't just doing the same thing. That's very exciting, that sense that you might be doing something that you haven't done over and over again, or someone else hasn't done over and over again.
You know, there is a song, I think it's an Ira Gershwin lyric, that goes, what can you say in a love song that's never been said before?
Mm.
I think that's the problem, really, that a lot of love poetry is up against, that there's actually been so much of it, in spite of what you're saying.
Well, I think you're right. In any poetry about happiness, we talk about this in class a lot. Why are the poems about grief better poems, mostly?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we write about our joy? And certainly what I see in the progression of my books is not so much the ones that have already come out as the ones that are waiting in the wings that are written but not out as books yet, is a progression in that direction. towards, many, many more poems of joy.
Can I ask you to read one more poem?
Sure.
It's called The Pope's Penis.
And, yes.
Okay, why don't you read the poem and then I'll ask you about it.
Okay. The Pope's Penis. It hangs deep in his robes, a delicate clapper at the center of a bell. It moves when he moves, a ghostly fish in a halo of silver seaweed, the hair swaying in the dark and the heat. And at night, while his eyes sleep, it stands up in praise of God.
I think you've really written about the subject that absolutely nobody is supposed to ever think about.
Right. Well, that's so... It's exciting. It makes you happy to think about and write about something that you're absolutely not supposed to. If you're a defiant person who has joy in defiance, and this I wrote this when this was first Pope, before I knew what was going to happen in terms of the Vatican's feelings about women's bodies and the use of them and their privacy and whose business it is to decide what and think what about women. It really wasn't consciously a political poem. I thought he was cute. And I really do have a feeling that we shouldn't ask each other to not speak. I really have that feeling that whatever you want to say about my poems, I shouldn't say to you, oh, don't say that, or please say what I want to hear. I really think we shouldn't do that with each other, and that the poets should say whatever they think, whatever comes into their mind, and then should play with it. Also, playing with the language.
The biggest problem is sometimes self-censorship.
Right. Right. Yes, so defiance helps.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us and reading some of your poems.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, Terry.
Sharon Old's latest collection of poems is titled The Gold Cell. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.